it's Bat Segundo here. And while I can't say I'm feeling brain dead, recently I've been feeling a little dead down there. I've tried everything to restore my virility. Viagra, penis pumps, and other exotic devices from mail order catalogs. But it just hasn't been enough to expand my half-inch shrimpy into a snossage of 5-inch proportions. Maybe it's because, like George Saunders, people think I'm a tool rather than understanding that I have a tool.
Okay, so I am here with George Saunders, who is now the author of The Brain Dead Megaphone. George, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Ed. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. And you're also a MacArthur Genius Grant now since the last I tried to talk with
that's
you.
That's what they tell me, yeah.
Did you get like 10% off at the supermarket for this?
Yeah, it's the biggest clerical error of the decade. But.
Well, anyway, to get off that subject and onto the book, I wanted to actually ask you, first of all, about the travelogue essays in this book. Your essays, The New Mecca, The Buddha Boy, and The Great Divider, and to some degree, A Brief Study of the British, seem to be written in this kind of fragmentary kind of approach, as opposed to a sustained effort. So I'm wondering if you feel this is the best way to, I guess, come to terms with being in a completely foreign locale.
I guess yes, but there are circumstantial reasons. You know, each one of those trips, each one of the GQ trips was a 10-day or 8 to 10-day thing. You know, so really quick. So really, in a certain way, the form would follow the experience. So you know, you go to a place and you're taking notes like crazy for 8 days, and you don't really know what's good or what's interesting. And then I'd come home and start writing them up. And as certain things, you know how it is when you're writing, sometimes a certain thing will just lurch forward and it's writable, you know, in some way that you didn't anticipate when you were there. So in a way, it was kind of like taking X number of those things, the ones that would sort of step forward and allow themselves to be polished. And then kind of trust that that was happening for a reason. In other words, it's funny, but the writing, especially at a high level of, you know, revision, it started to deeply reflect the emotional arc of the trip, even before I knew what the emotional arc was. So in other words, it's kind of like you picked out the 9 or 10 best bits, and those became the whole piece. So it's fragmentary, sort of, because I don't really have a coherent narrative when I go into it. I'm just looking around, you know. So those 10 things come forward, and you sort of weave them together. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, it sort of does. I mean, yeah. I guess it should start from, like, really taking copious notes or sort of unusual notes. Or?
It's just, you know, I go by myself, and I just write down everything that happens, you know. And even if it seems trivial, I just write it. Or, you know, I try to, like, if an opportunity presents itself. Like this guy here who just lost his backpack.
Yeah, yeah.
If this was a trip, I would be following him around, you know. So, and the idea is that you don't really know what's going to be interesting, so just take everything in. In other words, I guess the thing is, don't try to, as much as you can, try not to pre-process it, and don't decide your story before you go. And then even when you're there, you know, because we're neurotic beings, you know, who are afraid of failure, your tendency is to want to say, okay, oh, I know what the story is, you know, and then just edit out all other data. But the fun of that was to just say, well, I don't know what it is, and I won't know for 6 weeks when I get home, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering what observational criteria you place upon what you decide to write about. I mean, this guy with the backpack also interested me as well. I mean, is it just a matter of, I guess, an instinctive kind of choice, or do you feel that your, I guess, floodgates are open?
It's more that, yeah. And then also, I think sometimes, you know, like, say you go to Dubai, all right, and I went to Dubai because, again, it was the first piece, and I was nervous about screwing it up. I went with a pretty strong idea of how I would approach it. It was going to be, you know, dystopian, artificial hell with haves versus have-nots. That was kind of, I think that's why I got picked to do it, really, because of the Civil War land and all that. Well, then you go there, and you have that mind, you had idea in your mind, and at some point, something happens that knocks you off your trajectory. You know, and you go, oh, I'm full of it, you know. And so in that case, one of the things was having a conversation with this guy at this Wild Wadi theme park. He's a South African guy. And he said, oh, you Western writers, I'm sure that you'll try to find a little good and a little bad. But for me, Dubai has been a dream come true, you know. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. Because he's supposed to be the one who's screaming oppression, you know.
Sure. But,
so it's still, I think you look for those moments. I mean, right now, if I start castigating you, your arc is changing. You know, you kind of thought, well, maybe he's a reasonably nice guy, but suddenly he's mad. So I think on a trip, you look for those moments where your expectations are getting subverted and your ass is kind of getting kicked by reality. And then you just sort of go, okay, that's probably something. You know, if I'm noticing this in real time, it's probably something. You know, it's mostly intuitive, though, I think, you know. Mm. And also, it's mostly just, I have nothing else to do, so I just write down everything. Yeah. And then by the time you go home, you go, huh, those seven things were amazing. And that one that I thought was amazing on the first day actually was overturned by the third thing. And, you know,
But simultaneously, I mean, there's also the sort of a problem with kind of coming in with, I guess, preconceived notions, or even coming in and sort of, you know, veering off the trajectory, as you so mm-hmm. put it. I mean, Ben Ehrenreich, in his review of this book, actually took you to task in the LA Times for pulling your punches.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's really, I guess, no way to actually do this without at least, I guess, squelching certain observational kinds of aspects.
I mean, Ben's review, it puzzled me a little bit because I don't quite see how you can say someone pulled their punches if you weren't on the trip, you know? In other words, it's not like it seemed to me like he was expecting the first story, the story that I went there to write.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying to him and to other readers is, trust me, it was different for me, you know? Yeah. Now, so to go there and say, I want to write the dystopian story, I have to write it, even if my data contradicts it, that seems to me like, you know, that seems to me like a breach of integrity, you know? Mm. So, now, where he's right is that if you go for 8 days, or in that case it was seven, you're not going to see everything. And I'm far from a professional journalist. I mean, these pieces are more like idiot meets world, you know, that inflection. So it's kind of a given that I'm not an investigative journalist, you know. And so I think, I guess I felt like, well, if all you were doing was making up an idea about a story, going out into the world and taking the sort of most simple version of that, I'm not sure that's so interesting, you know. And the things that I, you know, the deflections I'm talking about are very earnest. I mean, I'm not like, now he's right about another thing, which is I really do like to be liked, and I like to like people.
Yeah.
And I guess I would just say, you know, indulge me, because in fiction, it's one of the reasons I write short stories, is because I don't like to nail real people. I don't like to. If I see, you know, a person who's full of hubris, I don't like to do that. I don't mind making up somebody who's full of hubris, you know, sort of a platonic version of that person. That I love. And I think but it's a different kind of work. You know, to say I'm going to pillory a human tendency is something I'm very comfortable with. To say I'm going to pillory it in you, Ed, it just makes me cringe and I don't like it. So I'm sure that he's right if that's a defect. But I would also say it's a big world, you know. So if somebody wants to go and be soft-hearted in a place, there should be some, you know, some room for that.
But if you like to be liked, doesn't this kind of get in the way of actually having to necessarily take conventions to task sometimes? I mean, you know, the other thing too is that going back to Ben's observation, I mean, I could actually possibly agree with him. Like, you commented upon the big screen TV with the web access, but you didn't, I guess, focus in on the fact that the web is heavily censored in Dubai, or, for example, the ecosystem, the problems of that caused by the man-made islands. So,
but see, I think that the problem is, if you, to my way of thinking, there are people who do that 100 times better than me. If you want a comprehensive story about Dubai, Ben would do it better, you know. Kind of the journalistic version, go there, tell me everything I need to know. But these pieces never, you know, in my view, if you're going for a week and you're really saying, here's one slice through the data, you know. So to me, it's not, I mean, there's, you know, I have a very, very limited talent, right? For me to go and try to be a true investigative journalist I would fuck it up. I don't know if I can say that word on your
podcast. You can say whatever you want.
Fuck it up. Because I don't really, I'm not trained in that. It doesn't interest me. So what I'm doing in these pieces is just saying, here's one subjective observer going in and seeing some stuff. And here's the thing. It would be false. No, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. But the thing that I don't feel is true is that you have to be... There's a kind of conventionality. Here's what I'm trying to say. There's a kind of conventionality to that approach that means everything must be balanced with a counterpoint, right? Sometimes the world isn't experienced that way. And if you try to manufacture that, I think it takes the energy out of it, you know? So for me to go into the hotel room in Dubai and simply say, here's the pluses and the minuses, is not actually true to the moment of being there, which, you know, so I'm not sure. I mean, it was an interesting review. The only thing I thought is it puts a writer in a funny position to have to do exactly in the nonfiction what's done in the fiction. And I think to say it, pulling the punches is sort of, in my way of thinking, it sort of presumes a lot about what the trip was like and what I'm like that I'm not quite ready to, you know, to admit.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, if you aren't an investigative journalist, are these entertainment pieces? I mean, where's the sort of, I guess, substantial import of these things? I'm not to suggest that there aren't interesting observations, such as you losing your credit card, for example.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I mean, it's interesting that you make that opposition because I'm not sure that, you know, I'm not sure I buy into the binary, you know, that there's serious investigative work with weight and there's entertainment. I mean, I think, this is one of the things that I found myself thinking about as I wrote the book, was that in the way that the news is presented now, there's always that assumption of serious, balanced stuff. Literature comes at it another way. It says it's all subjective, and one person's subjective experience is valuable, you know. So to me, yes, they are entertainment pieces. You know, they're in GQ, which is certainly happy to be, you know, and have an entertaining article and be lively and funny. So I guess I'm going on the assumption that a reasonably intelligent person being dropped into a place like that is of value because it gives you data that you don't get with the more objective sort of thing. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but like on the Minuteman piece, the Mexico one. I mean, here's the way it works for me. The early drafts are always really journalistic. They try to be, you know. And I'm so inept at it that it's just a bunch of statistics, basically, you know. And so that doesn't work. And really, the real reason I don't do it is I can't do it. I don't have the gift, you know. So therefore, I think, well, what gifts do I have? And one gift is I feel things strongly, you know. And I do try to like people. That's one of my gifts, you know. Now, maybe it's also a detriment in some ways, as you suggest. But it's, you know, after 48 years, that's kind of what you get, you know.
Yeah.
So then I think, all right, so it should be okay for one person who is in that position to drop into a situation, observe it in kind of a literary way, and offer it as kind of like a, I mean, I hate the phrase, but like a slice of life maybe or something like that. So I'm not sure. I mean, it's the idea that, I'll give you an example. When we were thinking about invading Iraq. Now, you and I were talking about it. Remember that time?
I remember. I remember it was behind the 7-Eleven.
We should have maybe picked a better spot to talk about.
I know,
about
it's it. Funny. We had the WMD Iraq connection way before they did. Yeah.
But, you know, when that discussion was going on, I think there was a lot of balanced reporting. You know, very rational balanced reporting. And some of that rational balanced reporting said things like, well, since weapons of mass destruction are a serious threat and the possibility of war is a very valuable deterrent, therefore, it might be, and so that all makes sense, you know. But then my thing would be for any one of us human beings to walk through the streets of Baghdad 6 days before the invasion, you'd go, oh, I see, so this is going to involve actual human beings. And I think literature can do that, and these kind of essays, I think, can do that in a way better than balanced realism. Now, is it 100% comprehensive? No. Does it find all the flaws? No. But I think what it does is it gives you a human, like a street level view of something. That for me, when I read pieces like those, it makes me feel that world isn't disconnected from my world. It's not some, you know, thing out there. It's actually on a continuity with my actual existence, if that makes sense.
So, well, I think what you're saying here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that essentially you can't kind of get away with your own particular perspective, your own particular sort of take, such as what I was suggesting earlier about the credit card and having to deal with a hotel room. So essentially, I guess, is this something of a limitation to this broader expanse that was the nitpicking that Ben did, or...?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's a real journalist. So for him, I think when someone says go to Dubai, he's got a particular model in mind of, you know, responsible reportage that, you know, that I was not attempting to enact. But also, I don't know. I mean, it's hard. I thought that. Yeah, let me just think about it, because I'm kind of it's like there's something about the idea that there's only one kind of reporting you can do, and it must be absolutely comprehensive. And if it's not sort of enacting, in a sense, a conventional view of Dubai, you know, then it's pulling punches.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, it's a pretty big world, and there are room for a lot of different slices through the data. But the main thing I thought about that review is that there, I mean, he's right. And, you know, I was, a very wise man told me once, when you get criticized, you should remember that it has something to do with you and something to do with the person doing the criticizing. Sure. And your job is to not throw out the part that's about you, you know, in your concentration on the other part. So for me, what was interesting about that review was that I thought, huh, that's true. There's a difference between fiction, what I do in fiction, and what I do in nonfiction.
Sure.
And the difference is, I really don't like, I would take no pleasure whatsoever in nailing a real person. I don't know why. And maybe, as you say, it means I will never be, you know, a muckraking journalist or a when I'm face to face, if I had to write about you, everything would be softened, you know. Even if you were aggressive to me, I have a hard time with that kind of confrontation. So, that, is it a defect? Well, it's a feature, I would say, you know. And when I become aware of that tendency, I try to work with it, like with those Minutemen in Mexico, or on the border. I was really trying to walk the line between, my sort of liberal idea, which is let's nail these guys, you know, and then the actual thing, which is they were different than I thought. Were they racist? Not exactly. There were some other thing that was kind of like a racist, but not quite. Were they dangerous? No. If there was more of them and they were better organized, they could be. If this was Italy in 1936, they would be. But right now, there's not enough of them, and they're bumblers, so no. But, you know, but so I think, you know, if Ben was talking about that piece, I think he would say, you know, you let the Minutemen off the hook, right? Hmm. But that has to do with the pre-existing idea of Minutemen that I didn't see.
Yeah.
So I think, so to me, it's, the other kind of writing that you're talking about is of course, 100% valid and wonderful, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
And for me to do that would be like just to take a 4.5 skill set into a game where other people are playing at 8 and 9 is just kind of silly. But you know, I mean, historically, it's of value for a person with all his flaws and subjectivities to go on the ground and do the best he can. And even, and I think, you know, a lot of times I think I'm confessing that tendency in myself, you know, that I like him. I like the Minutemen. You know, I can't help it.
Let's talk about some of the more sustained pieces. Like, for example, and actually this kind of gets at a similar point, but in your essay Nostalgia, you can openly confess that you've become a prude, and you point out that the level of sex and violence is going to continue to escalate. But I'm wondering is not adjusting to human progress a matter of like not passing judgment upon, say, the sexual practices of people, what they do in their own home, and how do you...
That's a completely tongue-in-cheek
thing. Yeah, but I mean, I'm wondering in terms of, like, you know, since it has the kind of, I guess, cadence of a personal essay and a certain persona that you bring to that, as well as the British one, I'm wondering where is the truth in something along those lines by saying...
I think Dylan said this in Chronicle. I think it's in Chronicle. He says something like, what I know to be true, sometimes I write what I know to be false, and sometimes I write what I'm not sure about. And I think, so for me, part of it is, you know, as somebody with a very limited talent, I feel like I gotta throw a lot of shit at the wall to see what sticks. In other words, I mean, that sounds a little pejorative, but I mean, I don't really know what will work. You know, I don't really know what I'll be good at. I don't know, like, if all this, when I die, you know, at 197 years old, I don't know what of my stuff will have had value, right?
Yeah.
So, and I got kind of a late start, you know, in writing. So my thing is, I'm really afraid of getting to the end and not having found my best voice, you know, my best stuff. And I think, you know, as a sort of neurotic, tight-ass Catholic, my tendency is to be careful, you know. Civil War land worked. Stay there, you know. But I did that for a few years after that, and it was really, I got into a self-imitating thing that was really revolting for somebody that young, you know.
Yeah.
So then I thought, oh, the hell with it. I would much rather get to my deathbed at 197 and say, wow, you tried a lot of stuff. What I don't want to say is you were too protective of yourself and careful. So in those kind of essays, I just, honestly, it's just like an idea comes into my head. I am a little bit of a prude, maybe, you know, but mostly not. And then, so, okay, what if I was? Boom, and then just go. I like the British one. What if I was me, but 40% dumber and less traveled? Okay, you know, just go. And I think that's actually in my view, a writer's job at the highest level is just to be a nut job, like to be kind of a seer, like channeling. You're channeling different things. You're letting different aspects of your personality manifest, you know, in a kind of joyful way that you're not worrying about too much, you know. Now that's what, you know, so when I go to Dubai and feel inclined to write that way, I'm just going to do it. I'm not going to worry about the niceties, you know.
Yeah.
That seems to me the only way. Otherwise, I don't know how you would do it, you know.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess is it a matter of being an impersonator? Like, you also, yeah, in that same essay, take the Black Eyed Peas to task. But, like, hump my stuffy, yeah, lumpy hump. I mean, that's no different from, like, yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy.
Right. But
you know?
I mean, to me, I don't know. I always feel like I'm not... I rarely want to take anyone to task. A couple times I have, but really I just want to play. Just want to play. And so when I, you know, the Black Eyed Peas, I kind of love that song, you know. And I think it's funny as hell,
yeah,
that it got written and that people like it, you know. And when I think of it compared to my Catholic childhood, you know, if someone had said, "Sister, can I perform Hump My Hump" or whatever, you know, it's a riot. So to me, the most holy feeling is the one of feeling like, isn't life fucking crazy? Isn't it wonderful? So I don't really, I mean, I got tagged pretty early as a satirist, and I'm not sure I really buy that. And I sometimes it's a drawback because people will say, oh, in fact, on your website, someone called me a tool, I believe, a huge tool, which I was hoping someone would misread it. You know, it has but my feeling is I always am celebrating, I hope, you know. And I think really you're celebrating kind of in prose energy, like in that Borat piece. I'm celebrating my relationship with that movie, you know, so I don't really, it depresses me when people think it's moralistic, because I don't really, I have so little confidence in my own moral judgments that I'm just completely wishy-washy. So for me, writing is a way of just sort of throwing out a bunch of things, and I think it's a healthy thing to throw out a bunch of ideas. If the ideas are relatively coherent in their own skin, if they're organic to themselves, I think it's a good thing to just, you know, if you have a thought, formulate it and extend it and see what happens.
So the Borat memo, do you like Borat? Or
I thought it was really funny, and the only thing, I think that came a little bit out of the, I'd been here in town, I heard, right before it came out, and I heard a lot of people that I liked and respected talking about it as this great anti-Bush movie, so I'm like, great, I'll go see it. So the only thing, I mean, and again, it was literally, I saw it on Thursday, wrote the piece on Friday, end of story. You know, it's just a gut reaction. And I thought, I think I was reacting against this idea that it was some kind of political thing. Now, if it was just Jackass with an accent, I think it was great, you know. But it was the idea that it was saying, you know, in the promos it would say, telling America the truth it doesn't want to know about us, or something like that. And I'm like, which of us at this point in our lives doesn't know that there are racist homophobes in America, one? So it seemed to me it was if it was just funny, I'm all for it. But the politics, the rhetoric of the movie is flawed. If you're criticizing something, you cannot edit as heavily as he does, in my view. You know, in other words, if you want to prove to me that an old guy at a rodeo is a racist, okay, that's kind of fun. You can do that. It's not hard. But to me, the interesting thing starts after that, when you say to him, "This is my friend Len. He's gay. We're going out." You know. So for me, it was partly just that it had been, in my mind, it had been pushed as kind of a political thing, and I don't think it's rhetorically set up to be political. But, and also that it was mean. There are things in there that aren't fair. I mean, and I'll tell you why I know that. I just come back from that Mexico story, and I met this Minuteman who was a nice guy, but kind of one of the brighter ones, like the most well-read of this group of guys. So we're in a diner, and he starts saying, and it's me and like 9 or 10 of these guys, and it's basically kind of a Republican gun club is what it really is. So he says, they're all kind of talking about their weapons and swaggering, and I had announced myself as a leftist, you know, liberal elite guy.
Yeah.
So this guy says, what we should have done is firebomb Fallujah, you know. And yeah, we should have done it. And I said, well, do you really think that's, I mean, I tell the story in the book, but do you think that's really fair? And he says, yeah, you know, you do it once, you don't have to do it again. Yeah. I said, okay, but, you know, there's like, say, 30,000 women and children in Fallujah. Do you really sanction burning them to a crisp? Well, you know, you give them a warning. That's, you know, give them a warning first. I said, okay, we gave them a warning in New Orleans. You know, so now maybe you're down to 15,000 dead, you know. And to his credit, in front of all his friends, he went, yeah, you're right, I wouldn't do it. So my point is, having been through that, then if I wanted to cut that after the first exchange, then I've got some hard-hitting journalism. Then I haven't pulled my punches, right? I asked the Minuteman what he said. Firebomb Fallujah. I said, really? He said, do it once, you don't have to do it again. Later that day, right? So in a way, I felt that there that the Borat movie, and I think to some extent Michael Moore's stuff, is full of this kind of cheap edits, you know, that they seem to be making a rhetorical point, but if you really examine the cuts, I don't think you'd find that it was true.
But the thing is in Sacha Cohen's case, it was marketed that way, but did Sacha Cohen really have that kind of effect of how his movie would be perceived?
I mean, he he said that at the Oscars, or one of the shows. He said this, you know, something like about America taking. That line is from him. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's absolutely right. But here's the thing. To me, okay, and maybe this goes back to the point about wanting to be liked, and you know, my fatal wuss quality or whatever. But when you go to somebody's house, as he did, and you say to his wife, you know, you're in my country, you wouldn't be so pretty, whatever he said, you know. That,
yeah.
To me, it just seems like, wait, what's the... It's funny. It could be funny, I guess.
Yeah.
But it also seems kind of mean, you know, and it seems mean in a way that you think, well, is that hard to get that? You know, is that a hard thing to do? No. Is there any rhetorical value in it? Not really, you know, to say, to sort of lure somebody in and embarrass them. I mean, what do you think about it? I mean,
well,
my
view on it, I mean, I liked
he's a genius. The guy, and the fact that, you know, I wrote that piece and I got more hate mail and also like mail than I've ever gotten on anything.
Yeah.
That's a tribute to him, you know, because that movie is rhetorically, it's shifting sands. You start talking about it and it opens up all kinds of issues. So I don't deny for a minute he's an incredibly talented guy, you know.
Well, one might sufficiently sort of argue that satire in American film and possibly in American letters had been playing it safe for so long that something like...
But that's actually, to be honest with you, that was my first reaction. I was so disappointed in how conventional the movie was.
Well, it's certainly conventional, but for the minds of, I guess, you know, the mainstream public who are not used to, like, someone coming in there and just shaking up constructs like that, that is pretty...
But which constructs did he... I mean, what I don't understand, and this is a sincere question, which constructs did he shake up?
He was shaking up, yes, predictable targets of middle-class middle-class life and the like, and... The point is no one had actually gone in there. I mean, why do you think, for example, like Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are so popular these days? I mean, it's interesting, though. The question becomes whether it's simple pranksterism or whether the political label kind of gets attached because people are so desperate, perhaps. And what do you think on this? People are so desperate to have some sort of, I guess, political satire? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, to me, I'll tell you what was interesting. When I saw the movie in Syracuse, there was... strange, weird laughter at all the anti-Semitic stuff that was not laughing at the right thing, right? In other words, they were laughing because Jews were being made fun of, right? That was an interesting thing. And there were also those of us from the university who got the joke. That may also be part of his genius, is that he turns all the paradigms around. But to me, when I think about middle-class America, that's a pretty big label to put on anything. You know, middle-class America, that's me, and that's a lot of people I know. And I don't think that, in my view, you know, that movie didn't tell me anything that I didn't know. You know, having come from Southside Chicago, lived in Amarillo, Texas, worked in a slaughterhouse, it just seemed to me like an easy thwacking of targets that he set up and then knocked down. So, I mean, maybe talk more about it, because I'm interested. I know. I caught a lot of flack for it, and I got called, you know, young fogey and tight ass. And I don't mind that.
And Tool. I kind of like.
But you know, it's interesting to me to... Let's get serious here. Is it possible that in our country right now, in our intellectual community, we are as habituated as the people we criticize? In other words, I've never seen so much anger as when I criticized Borat, right? And I criticized him in kind of a light, you know. I mean, I wasn't trying to tear his guts out. It was just a kind of a joke, really. But I wonder, in some ways, if shouldn't it be possible for someone to say about a movie that's talking about middle class America, "You got it wrong," right? You, I know evangelicals. They got a lot of issues, but the ones you're naming aren't them. And you didn't do anything. You talk about comprehensiveness now, you know, that you didn't do anything to balance that portrayal, you know, of evangelicals who, for example, sat up with my dying father-in-law in Oklahoma City night after night, including the janitress who prayed with him, you know, at a time when he needed something, you know. So my feeling is, I don't really think, I was actually, when I walked out of that movie, I thought, oh, man, I thought that was going to be radical, you know. And instead, it took all the, I'll tell you something else. When I was first came out here to go to grad school, I was about 28, and I'd been living in Amarillo, Texas, working in a slaughterhouse, kind of really at a low ebb. Like, I was really confused and making a lot of mistakes. And so I came out here, and I had Kerouac on the brain. I thought, these guys will love me. These Ivy League kids will love me because I'm so authentic. You know, like, I'm such an idiot that they'll feel the stench of authenticity on me. So I come out here, and no one in this group of people that I knew wanted to know anything about Amarillo. It was just that Amarillo was a joke on I-40. You know, yeah. It's where the big Texan steakhouse was. Ha, ha, ha. Lots of bail bondsmen. And I'd been in this three-year thing there where, you know, there was it's all kinds of deep personal issues going on in our family and stuff. And very, I mean, you could write a beautiful book about Amarillo that, in that period if you were a better writer than I am. So I came east, and I was really struck by the conventionality of the intellectual mindset. You know, in other words, there was some incredible generalization going on about everything east of here and west of L.A. that was kind of mind-boggling, because I assumed that that people were interested in it. So I felt the same thing in Borat, that there was this kind of sneering thing about them with a capital T, and making the mistake that we would accuse the right of making, which is you're not looking at individuals, you know. Is it really the case that everybody in the South is a racist? No, it isn't. And is it a case that at that little dinner party that those people were being racist? I don't think so. You know, so I'm not, I mean, you might be right that maybe I'm attributing, I'm guessing that Cohen is a brilliant enough guy that as I talked about earlier, you don't really plan this shit out. You don't think rhetorically. You're just trying to make energy, and he's very good at that. So I felt it was fair enough to say, yeah, you're making energy, but when you go to a gypsy village and trick a guy into wearing a sex toy on his hand, an 85-year-old guy, is the energy you get worth the joke, you know? Because I don't know if you read that piece online, but there was a whole thing about that village that they didn't really realize what they were involved in, and he paid him like $200 or something to let them fill a house with cow shit, you know, and so on. And the old guy who wore the fake hand was really kind of heartbroken that he had been tricked, you know. Yeah. So to me, that seems to me so far off the kind of progressive agenda, you know, to go into a sickly poor village and exploit them for laughs. It's kind of like, and I know what, now that's where I get called a young fogey, because I don't like that. I think it's not right, you know. And the effect is easily gotten in another way. Anyway, I'm talking.
No. This is all very interesting. I mean, is there any? What is the exact level of how much you will take someone to task? Then, if you're,
you can. I think you can take people to task 100%. It's not about. But who is he taking to task when he goes to the gypsy village? That old guy?
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, haha, dumbass, you wore a sex toy on your hand. Gotcha. You know, that isn't taking a task. So in a certain way, that's, I thought, the rhetorical. Again, if you allow me to treat it as a political thing, the rhetorical stance of that movie doesn't take anybody to task, really. And it takes people to task at different levels, you know. You can go into a white middle class home and edit so that they look like idiots, but when you're talking to the guys in the hood, he's not asking them questions that would cause them to say embarrassing things. He's going around it. And so my sense is, if you want to, taking the task is important. However, two things. One, I feel like in my world, fiction is a better place to do it than other places.
Sure.
But if you're going to take the task, you got to take the right people to task. You have to, and also I would argue, especially in this political climate, taking the task is easy. And I would disagree with you that we don't see enough of it. I think you go on any blog in the world, somebody's taking somebody to task. You know, go on Fox. Someone's being taken to task. Go on Air America. That's what we do in America. We take people to task, right? And when you say that phrase enough, it becomes weird. Take a task.
It sounds Goebbels.
But what I think we don't do, in my opinion, and maybe this is me getting old, but we don't go beyond the first impression to say, all right, here's a guy who's a conservative Christian who puts out a pamphlet every week about gays and how he doesn't like them. Who's a redneck, you know. Now, at that point, what do you do? What we tend to want to do these days is kick the shit out of them. You've miniaturized them, you've reduced them, you've basically given yourself permission to not think anymore and twack them, you know. But my point is, literature is really about the next step, which says, yeah, that is all true, and it's all horrible. Now, is he transmutable? Is there anything in him that could be changed and saved? Maybe not. And then you can hit him, you know. But I think what we don't do well at all is go beyond, for example, liberal conservative. That we don't do that. So one of the things in the Dubai pieces, the energy I was following, or the GQ pieces, the energy I was following was not the comprehensive energy, but the energy of going beyond the easy hit. You know, is Dubai a culture of have and have nots? Oh God, yeah, definitely. Okay, is there anything beyond that? In other words, why? Like when you see a reprehensible action, I find it really interesting to try to understand how such a thing is possible. You know, in other words, when Hitler woke up in the morning, I don't think he was going, he's going, yeah, 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 I'm the most evil man in the world and shall always be remembered as so. I think he was saying, it's going to be a good day. We're going to accomplish some things. Now, that is really spooky thought. That's almost like the most horrifying vision of humanity you could have. But to me, it's so fascinating to try to think, okay, when I do something really wrong, to me, it doesn't seem that way. And I think literature is about that job, of getting behind the screen and thinking about it that way. So I would have loved to have seen Cohen, and I know he's done this in other formats, and yeah. You know, and I don't really know his other work, but I would have loved
check out Ali G. It's,
oh no, I know, but I would have loved to have seen him take that old guy at the rodeo, you know what I'm talking about, the one who's take him out to coffee, and just say, you know, I'm gay. And I will bet you that he would have gotten a surprising reaction from that. Because I've been in this. I went time when I was working as an engineer. We did a wastewater treatment survey down in Tennessee, and we had to, you know, you had to sit on this catwalk all night, and every 15 minutes you had to take a water sample. And this was really, really backcountry. And it was the only time in the last 15 years I've ever heard racial pejorative with no apologies. You know, we were all white, so therefore this guy could say what he wanted. And one of the people on the crew was this obviously gay man, really nice guy, a friend of mine. And it was just interesting to see the way that these people would, I'm sure their feelings were not good towards him, but they were actually quite nice to him, you know. Or like in this Minuteman trip, the guy who wanted to firebomb Fallujah, one of the journalists who he'd been blasting as a left-wing stooge, blah, blah, hurt his knee, and as the guy went down, this kid just instinctively went and caught him. You know, so I think it's not that I'm never trying to sell a program, but for me personally, that's what's interesting. You know,
is it a matter? I mean, and I've got tons of questions. I'm gonna have to squeeze into the next.
Oh, it's so fun.
Yeah, I know. But Freytag's triangle, which you use to go into that Barthelme story, the perfect gerbil. I'm sorry, in the essay, the perfect gerbil, right. The Barthelme story of the school. I mean, is really. Everything you do in terms of trying to actually find this truth or this personal sort of experience, is it related to this idea of rising action? Is this kind of what dictates? Is that basically what all fiction and all writing boils down to?
Well, yeah, because rising action means progress, right?
Yeah.
So if you, you know, and in terms of what we've been talking about, if you say, I hate Republicans, okay, then if you stay there for the next 20 years, then you're at stasis. You know, you haven't, there's no rising action. Whereas if you look behind the curtain, suddenly there's rising action. So I think in a certain way that's true. But so, I mean, I think in writing, you gotta go where the energy is. That's, I mean, actually, you know, it's funny because they have like some semblance of a career after all this time is surprising, you know, and you do find yourself saying things that sound kind of programmatic, you know, but honestly, for me, I know that 90% of what I write will be stupid, and the only animating principle is if I go for where the energy is in my particular prose. So, in a certain way, I don't give a shit beyond that. I can't, you know, because I know, like, I'm working on a piece now for GQ that's another one of these travel pieces, and I've got a 30,000 word draft that is pure journalism and is the most boring thing you've ever read in your life. So I know I got to go back and do my thing on it, which is to get the energy to come out, no matter what. And everything else that might be good about literature comes out only after you've done that step.
But is it solely based off of this kind of Esther Forbes sort of precise sentence as
no,
well as
no, that's thing? Part of it. But it's obviously, you know, I mean, again, when you teach or when you do this kind of interview, you're always trying to pithily say what it is, but of course, as you know, it's that moment where your fingers are above the keyboard and you're like, please don't suck, and then something happens, hopefully, that's visceral and intuitive. So you're trying, I mean, it's like in sex, you know, if you had a really good night and someone said, how'd you do that? You say, well, I concentrated. I mean, you can make up a story about how you did it, but the truth is, in the moment, you were in it. And I think that's really, you know, 99% of the truth about writing is you're trying to get to that place where something inexplicably nice is happening. And afterwards, you might try to reduce it, but it's always approximate.
I guess I'm just curious, in terms of the notion of rising action, how this would apply to something like, say, Nicholson Baker's really hyper-specific sort of details, or, say, William Gaddis's party scenes in The Recognitions, or even Gilbert Sorrentino's long list of names.
Right. Well, one thing is, there's no absolutes. So if it works for me, that's one thing. But the second thing, I think you could argue that if I sit here right now and started listing every address at which I'd ever lived, and let's say it's a very long list, right? And when we get to hour two, there's a form of rising action, which is you're ready to kill me, you know? So I think that, you know, there are lots of different, it's not a plot, I'm not talking plot, but yeah. I think it's just that the expectation, you know, when I say, hey, Ed, you're not going to believe what just happened to me, you lean in, right? So I think there's a million ways of doing that. And I think the thing is every person has to find their way of making that happen. If it doesn't happen, and all the ways that you mentioned, I'd say those are absolutely rising action, you know. If it doesn't happen, then the reader just feels condescended to and walks away. So however you do it, I've got to say, we're in a conversation. Come here, I'm going to tell you something. You lean in, and I start telling you. That whole trick is to keep you leaning in by whatever means necessary. For me, rising action is a nice way to think about it because, you know, everyone has written those 60-page expositional things, you know, where really nothing happens. And I noticed that, for me, knowing that there is such a thing as rising action was a nice help. But all, you know, in writing, everything is nonsense. Everything, nobody knows anything, as William Goldman says about movies. So I can get up here and say, you know, show, don't tell. But as anyone who's ever tried to write something knows, it's nonsense. You know, you have to, and also you have to take into account your own neuroses. Like for me, the reason I tend to be pretty savage in fiction is because I so much don't want to be savage in real life.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. I mean, Freud would, you know, any Freudian analysis, it would have a field day. But I think with all of us, we all have something like that. And the point of fiction is to find out how to exploit the weakness that you have rather than dominate, you know, the world and always be right. If you, like me, are, this is a funny phrase to use about yourself, but tender-hearted in the sense that I'm flinchy, you know. I don't like confrontation. Like when this woman came over right now to ask if we were recording, I couldn't concentrate on the answer because I didn't want to hurt her feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I think the beauty of being an artist is at some point you go, all right, fuck it. I can't pretend I'm not who I am. I have to embrace, I have to fall into being who I am. And only then, at the end of that long fall, do you actually get something that sounds like you. But which sort of, especially for men, I think it's counterintuitive because you think you're supposed to master all modes. You know, I'm going to be Faulkner plus Hemingway plus Kerouac. But I think it's that sort of acknowledgement that basically you can't do very much. And you're lucky if you can do any of it on a good day. And it's going to be in a voice that you don't really like. Like, I don't really like that I like people so much. Well, I guess that's not really true. I do, actually. Yeah. But, you know, there are things about my voice, my physical voice, for example, that, you know, I don't particularly, this is not the one I would have chosen, you know. And when I was young, I used to do a thing when I was in high school. I was really trying to be a good kid, you know. And I remember doing this thing where I'd straighten my back and kind of try to speak slower in a more melodious way. That way, you'll sound more professional, you know. And, of course, you do that, and you're full of shit. So, for me, the writing thing is relaxing into the actual voice, and saying, well, I can't help it, you know.
But in terms of, and this will be the last question.
Oh, no, I'm having a great
time.
But
momentary advocacy of something like the simple rising action template, which isn't exactly the entire foolproof version of how to write.
Totally.
How does this work in relation to you must write in your particular voice? This is the voice you were given?
Well, what I tell my students is don't trust me. Like, I'm going to throw a bunch of ideas at you, some contradictory. And your job as a student is to open up and see what rings your bells. Right? It's not that, I mean, you would be a fool if you taught writing as the way you taught engineering, right? My thing is, I don't know you, I'm going to try to know you. In fact, after 3 years, I am going to know you, and I'm going to throw some Zen shit at you, because I know that you're secretly blocked up in this area, and I'm going to say something that I know isn't true to rattle your cage, you know. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to say, like, rising action is an interesting idea, and like all interesting ideas, it's flawed, you know. So, but it's a good way to start, you know, to get in. And I think, you know, to talk about Barthelme that way was fun because he doesn't rise the action in a conventional way in that story of the school. You know, he does it partly with the voice, you know. And when he does rise the action, he does it in a real simple pattern. And his genius is in the way the pattern's not too complex and not too simple. So I'll go back to that Dylan idea. I love the thought that put it this way, if you were having a relationship issue, which you may be, I don't know you very well, but if you were, and you were in a desperate situation, you were really like, oh God, I'm, you know, do I feel qualified to give you the one line of advice that would save your life? Fuck no, I don't. But could I throw a bunch of shit at you? Yeah. And I think if I threw six things at you that were coming out of friendship, maybe one of them would open the key. So I think in a certain way, as a teacher, and I think as a public, you know, quasi-public intellectual, that's your job, is to throw the most sincere things out you can, even if they're not consistent, even if they're not particularly coherent, in the hope that it'll ring somebody's bell.
Sure.
Or perhaps throwing them a sort of prism with which to actually kind of find their own particular take. Is that what it boils down to?
That's all it can be, of course. I mean, there's no way there could be anything else, right? I mean, the best students that I've had were students who disregarded 99% of what I said, you know, and there was maybe one tiny thing that it didn't teach them, it just gave them permission to bless what they already knew, that kind of thing. So I don't think it's a problem, and pontificating is a problem because it becomes sort of a career thing. Like if you get to a certain level, you're asked to pontificate. And the one thing I know about writing is it's all nonsense. You know, it's all nonsense. I've done it time and time again, taking my own list of dogma into the writing room, and none of it works. You know, it's all wrong. So that's what I love about it. It's like being a plumber with constantly changing pipes and the wrong tools, and it's in an earthquake and you're drunk, you know, that kind of thing. It's every story has a different trigger, you know. Gotcha. So yeah.
Well, George, I have thousands more questions to ask you.
We'll do it again sometime.
But
it was so enjoyable.
Definitely. Thanks so much, George.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
My heart ain't a broken, 'cause that implies it was ever in one piece before tonight. Paradise is poison.